Our passage this morning comes from Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah chapter 6. Let's read through the text and get it in front of us again. Isaiah chapter 6, beginning at verse 1. In the year of King Uzziah's death, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne, high and lifted up, and the trails of his robe were filling the temple. Seraphs were standing above him. Each one had six wings. With two he would cover his face, and with two he would cover his feet, and with two he would fly. And this one called out to that one and said, "Holy, holy, holy is Yahweh of hosts. His glory is what fills all the earth." Then the foundations of the threshold shook because of the voice of the one who called out, and the house was filled with smoke. And I said, "Woe to me, for I'm destroyed. For I'm a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. Indeed, my eyes have seen the King, Yahweh of hosts." Then one of the seraphs flew to me, and in his hand was a glowing coal. He had taken it with tongs from the altar, and he let it touch my mouth, and said, "See, this has touched your lips, and your guilt has been taken away, and your sin will be covered." Then I heard the Lord's voice saying, Whom should I send, and who will go for us? And I said, "Here I am, send me." Then he said, "Go, and you shall say to this people, go on hearing and do not understand, go on seeing and do not come to perceive. Make the heart of this people fat, and make their ears heavy, and make their eyes blind, lest they should see with their eyes, and hear with their ears, and understand with their hearts, and turn and get healed." So I said, "How long, O Lord?" And he said, "Until cities crash into ruins without any residents, and houses contain no people, and the ground is ruined, a devastation. And Yahweh shall remove people far off, and the forsaken place is huge in the midst of the land. And when there is yet a tent in it, it too will experience burning, like the terebinth and like the oak, which when felled, their stump remains. The holy seed is its stump." Sometimes you can have a privilege that is not all it's cracked up to be. Wilmer McLean knew about that in about April 9th, 1865, when in his parlor at a place called Appomattox Courthouse, Lee and Grant signed their terms of the surrender of the Army of Northern Virginia. And it was after that took place, that one general took the table, I think he paid for it, took the table on which the terms had been written. Another general took the table on which the terms had been signed. Some other officers asked, I think most of these were Federals, asked to buy a chair and so on. If it was refused, they just took it off on their horse. And some of the cane-bottom chairs were cut out, and strips of it were handed to officers in the courtyard. They knew it was a historic moment, and they wanted to have souvenirs. That was a privilege of Wilmer McLean to have Lee and Grant meeting in his parlor, making history and devastating, eventually, his house. Now, that's that way here, I think, with seeing the Lord. One can be glad it was Isaiah. We can watch at a safe distance. It's very sense-oriented, isn't it? You notice as you go through, it talks about what he sees and what he feels and what he hears. We look at this text this morning because this holy God sends forth servants. Sounds to me like mission conference material. And yet, we must see that there is a terror in God's holiness. Let's walk through the text to see what it says to us, as Isaiah reacted and said, "I am destroyed." Now, let's notice first what he sees. A dreadful God, verses 1 to 5. You see the big word here, don't you, in verses 2 to 4, it's the word holy. That's the massive fact about the God of the Bible. Holy, holy, holy is Yahweh of hosts. His glory is what fills all the earth. Now maybe we can get an idea of what holy means or what holiness is just from scratching away at this text in itself. We can say some things about it. Holiness is extraordinary, for one thing. You know, that's obvious, of course. But you notice here that even these seraphs, who must be sinless, angelic order, a sinless angelic order of beings, even the seraphs cover, each one covers his face and each one covers his feet. It's as if in the majesty of this holy God, even they must somehow bring a barrier to some degree, a kind of a protection. So whatever holiness is, it's extraordinary in the sense that it's not mere sinlessness. It's beyond that. Apparently the seraphs are sinless, but this is even more. Even they, as it were, flinch in the presence of this God. You remember how crown of many crowns goes with one stanza. No angel in the sky can fully bear that sight, but downward bends his burning eye at mysteries so bright. A.W. Tozer said, God's holiness is not simply the best we know, infinitely bettered. We know nothing like the divine holiness. He says the natural man may fear God's power and admire his wisdom, but his holiness he cannot imagine. Holiness is extraordinary. It's incomparable. And then you see here that holiness, though, is thrilling. You know, again out there, the seraph, each one cries to the other with this refrain in verse 3, holy, holy, holy is Yahweh of hosts. His glory is what fills all the earth. It's thrilling. In what sense? Well, back up just a minute and talk about that three times mentioning of holy. That's a way Hebrews have of making something, putting something in bold print or capital letters or exclamation marks. You repeat it. There's a text in Ezekiel 21, verse 27, where the Lord is telling king of Judah that he's going to decimate the kingly line. And he says, a ruin, ruin, ruin I will make it. Utterly, completely desolate. That's the way of emphasizing. Here, though, it's a positive one. Holy, holy, holy. It's holiness in excelsis, you could say. But what I want you to see here is that this is back and forth praise between the seraphs. This is what they say to each other. It's praise. And these seraphs find this, therefore, delightful. The repetition shows their excitement and their enthusiasm over this massive fact about God. It thrills them to the bottom of their burning beings. That God is like this. Holiness is thrilling. That's what's being said there. But then holiness is aggressive. You notice what it says after the three times of holy. It says, His glory is what fills all the earth. Now, glory is holiness made visible. Glory is the wrapper that's around holiness, if you want to put it that way. It's either a statement of fact here, or it may be indicating what is going to be the place, the fact, rather. His glory is what is going to fill all the earth. So holiness isn't some dormant, reclusive quality that God has. Rather, it's an aggressive quality. It's going to be displayed throughout all creation. And then, though, holiness is alarming, isn't it? You see what Isaiah himself says in verse 5. Woe to me, for I am destroyed in the light of this God, because he's the opposite of what God is. He's unclean. I'm a man of unclean lips. Now, unclean there, I don't think is used in a ceremonial way. Primarily, it's primarily used in what we might call a moral sense. It's the and Isaiah sees himself as the opposite number, you might say, of God's holiness, and that implies, doesn't it, that there's of God's holiness, that there it indicates a moral purity and perfection in God's holiness. Perhaps after we scratch around in the context to try to see qualities and something about what holiness is here just from the context, perhaps we can say, just in a kind of a back pocket definition, that God's holiness is the awe-inspiring majesty of the godness of God. Now, that's the big word. But the sad truth is there in verse 5 when Isaiah says, I am destroyed. Now, why does he think that? Why is he so alarmed? Well, because of his lips and because of his sight. I'm a man of unclean lips. And then he says, for my eyes have seen the King. Those words are emphatic. The King, Yahweh of hosts. Now, what's all this concern about unclean lips? What's the big deal there? Why does Isaiah focus on that? I think maybe for a couple of reasons. For one thing, he is to be a prophet. And he's to speak Yahweh's word. And yet he has unclean lips. That disqualifies him from his vocation. It would be like an auto mechanic who had both his arms amputated. How do you do it then? How does a prophet, so when he has unclean lips, how can he speak Yahweh's words? And then there's something more, too. He can't join in the praise of the seraphs in their worship because he has unclean lips. So his unclean lips hinder both his vocation and his worship. Now, you know how Isaiah would respond to this. He wouldn't, if he referred to this, he wouldn't just crinkle up his shoulders and say this was just the meanest experience. You know, he would say this was the most dreadful moment of my life. I would never want to go through this again. There's an implication, or the major implication for us, of this dreadful God, of this God whom Isaiah sees in this vision. I think you have here a sample of one of God's finest gifts. In this sense, Isaiah was already a believer when he had this vision. I don't want to go into how chapter 6 relates to chapters 1 through 5 and get into all that right now. But Isaiah was not a pagan here. He was already a believer. In our categories, in our lingo, we would say this was a post-conversion experience. And one of God's best gifts to you as a Christian would be similar to the one that Isaiah received here, to give you an overpowering and increasing sense of how total and filthy your corruption of your nature is, of how deeply tangled and perverse and devious you are, and a sense of your own uncleanness. I hope you understand that sometimes that comes more powerfully to you. After your conversion than it does before. John Murray was for a number of years professor of systematic theology at Westminster Seminary in Philadelphia, and there's that one anecdote in his Ian Murray's little biography of him that talks about Professor Murray being at dinner one Sunday at the house of their pastor, Reverend Freeman. And as they sometimes do, they talk about theological topics, and they were talking about the depth of human depravity, of the innate sinfulness of the human heart, and so on. And Professor Murray was carrying on a little bit about this and speaking about it. Well, in the process of conversation, Mrs. Freeman said to Mr. Murray, and I think she meant it in jest, and I don't think Murray picked up on that. You know how some people can be a little, you know, can bypass them. But she said, "But Mr. Murray, we know that you're not as bad as that." Well, Murray just had one good eye, and he fastened it on Mrs. Freeman. And he said to her in his sternest voice, "Mrs. Freeman, if you knew what a cesspool of iniquity this vile heart of mine is, you would never say such a thing." It helps to see who we really are and how deep our uncleanness goes. Even as Christians, you say, what's that got to do with missions? It has to do with missions because God always seems to begin with the missionary. And whether you're serving in Kenya or whether you're doing plumbing in Charlotte, you begin with your own unclean lips or you won't be fit to go anywhere. That's what he sees. Now, secondly, let's look at what he feels. A painful purging. Verses 6 and 7. "Then one of the seraphs flew to me, and in his hand was a glowing coal. He'd taken it with tongs from the altar, and he let it touch my mouth and said, 'See, this has touched your lips, and your guilt has been taken away, and your sin will be covered.'" Here's the response to the prophet's cry. Note that that glowing coal comes from a certain source. It comes from the altar. In Isaiah's vision, people debate, was that the what would be in the tabernacle or in the temple, the altar of burnt offering, or would it be what was the altar of incense and so on? Well, in one way, it doesn't really matter, and we can't really know, I suppose, but it does indicate it was God's provision, because the altar of burnt offering was where sacrifices were offered as substitutes for God's people. And the altar of incense was where the priest would, as it were, intercede for the people. So this speaks of God's provision. Now you notice the pain that's involved. The seraph takes it with tongs from the altar. It's a glowing coal. Why does he do that? Because even a seraph doesn't want to get burned. It's apparently a live coal. He takes it with tongs. And then, I know it's a vision, but don't you just cringe when you read it? Don't you wince? And he let it touch my mouth. And then he doesn't say, "Just let this be a charade." He interprets it. "See, this has touched your lips. Your guilt has been taken away, and your sin will be covered." Now, we have an altar. That's a quote, Hebrews 13:10. We have an altar, and it stands outside Jerusalem originally. You go on reading down in Hebrews 13:10 and following. The altar was there on Good Friday. It's the cross of Jesus. We have an altar where we can be purged. And you see, the good news about this is that when you have an altar where one was destroyed in your place, and you realize that the God who makes you see your filthiness is also the God who has provided for your cleansing. I wonder if you've ever thought, or given much thought, perhaps we do it too quickly, too easily, what would it be like if we didn't have an altar? What would life be like if there wasn't any atonement? In about 1945, in August, there was Admiral Onishi. He was in the Japanese naval operations. And well, it was really before August. It was earlier than that. Was by October of 1944 that he realized that Japan's sun was setting in the war in the Pacific. And if they were really going to be effective, they had to take more drastic measures. And so he said that what they needed to do would be have their flyers crash dive onto the carrier flight decks of American ships. There are zero fighters carrying 250 kilogram bombs. Suicide attacks, the kamikaze pilots, and so on. And it seemed to be fairly effective in a way. He felt there was no alternative but just to keep on with these inhuman tactics. And this program, if you want to call it that, cost 2,519 officers and personnel of the Japanese Navy. And then, in August of 1945, when the word came that the war was over and hostilities were to cease, that evening, Admiral Onishi left a note thanking the souls of his late subordinates for their valiant deeds, all 2,500 plus of them. In death, he said, "I wish to apologize to these brave men and their families." And with that, he plunged a Samari sword into his abdomen. He refused any medical aid. He forbade anyone to finish him off. He went on in agony until 6 o'clock the next evening when he finally died. Those who tell this story say his choice to endure prolonged suffering was obviously made in expiation for his part in one of the most diabolical tactics of war the world has ever seen. What's that mean, to make expiation? He was trying to make atonement. Isn't that sad when you can't make atonement? When there isn't any covering for sin? When you don't have an altar to which you can go? What you do. And so you do not have to worship the Lord merely in the terror of holiness, but in the safety of holiness. That's what he felt, painful purging. And then, thirdly, you see what he hears. Verses 8 to 13, a devastating message, what he hears. Now, there's a transition here, isn't there? Verse 8. Isaiah heard the Lord's voice. "Whom should I send and who will go for us?" And I said, "Here I am, send me." So here's Isaiah's freedom and his willingness to respond. And then you get the downer. It's not all bleak in verses 9 to 13. There would be what we could call a stump people. Now, this is I don't have the time to take you through this line by line and so on. When you get to the very last of verse 13, and there are problems in translating it, I know, blah, 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 and so on. But really, where it comes down to, there's still a stump, thinking of God's professing people. There's still a stump that remains. The holy seed is its stump. So when the people of God are decimated, they're still going to be what you might call a stump people, a remnant. Jesus just won't ever allow his people to be eradicated from the earth. Okay, so that's there. But on the whole, this is not a delightful, optimistic beginning if you're a prophet. Look at what the Lord tells him. For instance, the problem of his preaching, just in verses 9 and 10. It's as if he says, on the whole, Isaiah, they won't listen to you. That's verse 9. And verse 10, he says, your preaching will have a deadening, densifying, and deafening effect on them. It will just harden them further, and this is part of my judgment on the people of Judah. That's, again, not optimistic. What I want you to see here, though, especially in verses 11 to 13, is how this text underscores the honesty of God. I want you to see, in one sense, that this is relatively encouraging. In one sense. You notice when Isaiah says in verse 11, "How long, O Lord?" I don't think there he's asking how long must I go on preaching this way. I think he's asking, how long will this hardness of heart and refusal to listen to your word characterize your people? How long is this going to go on? Let me summarize what the rest of verse 11 through verse 13 seems to say. Yahweh's answer seems to be, until and through the time when the land is ruined and the people are taken captive from the land, and even when what's left gets wiped out again. That's a devastating message. But what I want you to see is that there's a certain kindness in a God who will tell you that ahead of time. You see how he deals with his servants. And I think there's a spillover here for not just any missionary, but any Christian. It's as if God says, what you do, Isaiah, is not going to be very successful in your situation. Now, please understand, I'm not saying this is always the case with Christ's servants. Right? But in this situation, in what, 740 B.C., etc., in Judah, in Isaiah's case, and in that situation, he was not going to be very successful in his vocation. He just wasn't. And it may be, in fact, he's saying, it may seem that you will be apparently fruitless, Isaiah. So Isaiah was to labor under no illusions. If he has little success, though, you see what this means. He doesn't need to despair about whether he really had a genuine call. He doesn't have to search his soul and say, maybe there's something defective in my ministry. No, the Lord told him up front that this wasn't going to go anywhere much. Wasn't that kind? Isn't God good? That he doesn't hold out secrets on us? No misconception. No. I have a 1997 Ford Ranger pickup. Oh, a little pickup. It's red. That paint's not in too bad a shape. I would have driven it up here this weekend, but Barbara came with me, and she doesn't care to ride in the pickup too much, so we had to bring the other one. But if I'd come by myself, I would have driven my pickup. Now, let's assume that I had brought my pickup, and some of you men, let's say, not that women don't drive pickups, but, you know, just you men might be more drawn to it. Maybe some of you men wanted to make a deal with me for my pickup. And I would feel, if you made an offer, that I would have to tell you certain things about that pickup. I would say to you, you need to understand the gas gauge doesn't work. So every time you fill up with gas, you punch the little odometer, the tripometer thing, so you have an idea of how far you can go on tank of gas. You have to punch it every time, I don't know, 10 years. The gas gauge hasn't worked. All right. Now the radio won't shut off. You're supposed to be able to punch the button there that regulates the volume, and it'll click and hold that button in, and it shuts off. But that quit working about 5-6 years ago. So the radio is always on, and if you don't want it on, you're hearing it, you just have to turn the volume clear down. So you need to know that. Then I'd have to say, now the gear shift. You're going down, and you put it in fifth gear, you know, and you're on the road cruising along. And you know that little thing there on the top, that plastic thing that shows you what gears, how to shift the gears and where they are. Well, that's loose. I mean, it doesn't come off, but it just kind of rattles and goes around. I suppose some super glue would fix it, but I never have. So it doesn't bother you if you don't listen to it. But if you happen to begin listening to it and get on your nerves, you have to keep your hand on the gear shift when you're driving down the highway. You may need to know that. Now, I want you to know, too, that the check engine light usually stays on. No big deal. Yeah, you can take it to the Ford dealership, and for $127, they'll get it off. And it'll stay off for about 36 hours, and it'll come back on. And you can take it in, and you can spend $80 more, and it'll do the same thing, and it'll come back just leaving on. It doesn't hurt anything. Nobody gets killed. No, so on. So it's all right. Then I would have to tell you also, you know, it was once wrecked. I slammed into the back of a nursery truck. We don't need to relive all this. But it had a firm steel iron back on it, and it just kind of crunched up the front of my pickup. But $3,000 or so repair, it's okay. But I just want you to know, you know, it's been repaired about 8 years or so ago, et cetera, from that. Now, I would tell you all that, and if I did that, and if you were still, you were really kind of interested in purchasing it, your wife, if you're married, might say to you, look, why do you want to buy an old pickup like that? That's stupid. And you say, well, this Davis guy tells me everything that's wrong about it. I think I can really trust him. Well, yes, of course. And some of us need to see that God deals with us that way. You can really trust this God that doesn't hide anything from you. Jesus is the same way, isn't he? John 16:1. These things I've told you that you might not fall away. What things? Oh, the stuff in John 15 about how the world will hate you, and you need to know all that stuff. But he tells you. And he tells Isaiah the situation he's going to face. This is the kind of God you have. Now, that's kind of countercultural. Sometimes in our Christian subculture, you know, we receive the impression from some folks that if you just have enough faith, and if you practice biblical principles of relationships, whatever that means, and if you bathe your activities in prayer, and if you formulate a ministry strategy, and if you come up and devise a workable vision statement, and if you attend the latest how-to conferences, and if you meet in a certain kind of small group, and if you subscribe to certain Christian magazines and so on, and ministry blogs and all of that, you can't help but have success in your Christian venture. Really? How refreshing to have a God like Isaiah's who tells you the truth. Isn't God good to tell you how very nasty and difficult and cruddy it may be? Isn't he kind to be like that? So that we not only worship in the terror of holiness and in the safety of holiness, but in the truth of holiness. Ooh, this God, good. You can trust. You can trust a God like this. Now, we haven't said anything, have we, about King Uzziah, who died in verse 1. So you can have a moment of silence for him here if you want to. But Uzziah reigned a total of 52 years in Judah. And he gave the nation a great deal of stability during that time. But now he's gone. But the Lord is still reigning. Remember, that's what Isaiah said. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting upon a throne. He's still reigning. And you may need to hear that. And you may need to hear that this holy God is the one that knocks you right out of your senses. For here you see and you feel and you hear that the holy God is a frightening God. And he's an atoning God. And he's a candid God. And when you come to think of it, that's the sort of God that tempts you to say, here I am, send me. Let's pray. O Lord, as your servant Hannah said long ago, there is none holy like the Lord. And we would add today, and there is none so kind as the Lord. O our God, we pray that you would make us able to tremble before your holiness and to rest in your kindness. for Jesus' sake. Amen.